The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, you spooktacular people. We want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving and to say how thankful we are for all of you listeners and supporters of the show. We just got back from a very busy road trip. We have a lot of audio to go through, and we're going to be enjoying our Thanksgiving together, eating a lot of grub. So this week, we're putting up this replay of one of my favorite interviews I've done with James Bartlett, who wrote Gourmet Ghosts, and he talks to us about his top 10 LA eateries. Enjoy. Have a happy and healthy Thanksgiving.
History tells the story of the world and of our lives. Sometimes that history goes bump in the night. Broadcasting from the center of oddity and the supernatural in Central Florida, it's the History Goes Bump podcast.
Hello, you spooktacular people. Welcome to the History Goes Bump Thanksgiving Special 2016. I am your host, Diane.
And this is Denise.
On today's episode, we have a special guest joining us. When it comes to Thanksgiving, what is something that comes to mind, Denise, other than pilgrims and Native Americans getting together?
Well, and also being thankful, but what definitely comes to mind is what are we going to eat?
Exactly. Food. And we have the perfect person joining us to talk about that. We are joined by author and journalist James Bartlett. He is going to share with us a top 10 of haunted eateries and bars in the Los Angeles area. James is originally from London. He's been a freelance journalist since 1999, and he's been living in Los Angeles since 2004. He's written about travel, entertainment, food, and the weird and wonderful side of LA in over 100 magazines and newspapers, including the Los Angeles Times, LA Weekly, Hemispheres, American Way, The Guardian, The Daily Telegraph, BBC, Film Ireland, Close Up Film, and BBC America. He's also contributed to Variety, Bazaar, The Historian, RTE Radio, and BBC Radio. And he is author of Gourmet Ghosts and Gourmet Ghosts 2, which feature murder, mystery, and history at dozens of bars, restaurants, hotels, and landmarks across Los Angeles. How are you doing, James?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you today?
We're doing great. That's a big switch to move from London to Los Angeles.
Yes, it was a bit. It wasn't something I'd ever imagined, as you can probably imagine. But I met the right person, and she lived here. And she had the proper job, whereas I'm just a freelancer. So I just thought, well, I'll have to give it a go in America.
So it's always the girl.
It's the girl.
It's often the way, isn't it? That seems to be the way. And yes, it's totally the way in my case.
Well, we have to ask, what made you decide to look into ghosts to begin with? You know, most freelance journalists out there, people start looking at you a little weird if you're like, well, I'm writing about ghosts.
Yeah, it really came about sort of partly because I was new to LA and I was going to some of the bars and trying to explore a little bit and learn a little bit about the city. And as a freelance journalist, when I was in a bar having a drink, I was talking to the bartender and he told me a bit about the history of the bar, and he said that it was haunted. So, of course, I thought, well, that would be an interesting story. And so I asked for some more details, and he gave me a few more details, and I went home and did my due diligence and looked it up in the newspaper archives and online and couldn't really find a great deal, but I did a bit of digging, and it just really snowballed from there. I talked to other people. And then I would just mention it in passing and people would say, oh, well, you must go to this place and you've heard this story and you've heard about this bar, haven't you? And you've heard about that bar and you've heard about this restaurant. And it just went on and on from there. And in the end, I just ended up collecting them. It was a good way for me to see a bit of the city as well and to have plenty to drink and to eat, obviously. And eventually I had a lot collected together, and I thought, well, what am I going to do with them now? And it was my wife who suggested, she said, well, you should put them together in some sort of guide, into some sort of book. And so I had a look in the bookstores and online to see if there was a guide that was like this. And there wasn't really one that was like this. So I thought, well, maybe there's a little niche for me there, and I'll give it a go. And, you know, here we are sort of 5 years later. Well, more than that, the first book I did over several years because it was more of a hobby. And then the second one I did a bit more focused wise. So now it's sort of many, many years. It seems like a million years later. And here we are. We've just had the second one out.
And so with your books, about how many eateries do you cover in each one, or different places?
It's 40 in each. And I usually probably research and discard or don't find anything good enough, or even reject very late. Double that, I would say. I mean, it's dozens and dozens and dozens I research for each one. I've got so many, lots of people at the events I go to always mention, you know, well, what about this hotel and what about that restaurant? And usually I've looked into it. And usually I tried to have a strict criteria for the books that they had to be somewhere you could go, like a bar or a restaurant or a hotel. You know, that's why it's kind of a guide. Otherwise, you're just looking, you know, through the windows and looking at old buildings that really could be anything. And they also had to have some sort of corroborating evidence, whether I talked to somebody who actually worked there or whether I found something in the newspaper archives that showed that something did happen there. There was a crime or there was a suicide or a murder. And that made a bit of a connection for me rather than taking the sort of more supernatural route where, you know, that maybe there's a psychic thing or someone says that, you know, they felt that there's a presence in the building. And I thought I needed a bit more information than that for it to be convincing. So that each chapter of the book and each entry was kind of like a little story. So you learned a little bit about the building, a little bit about the architecture, a little bit about what it was like inside. Then I'd tell some of the stories and the people I'd spoken to. Then a bit of the history and the true crime, and then something about the food and the drink that you could have when you were there. So it's kind of a supernatural dating guide, if you like.
Sounds fantastic. Do you have a location that stands out above some of the others that's like one of your favorite locations, whether it be for the ghosts, the stories, or the food?
That's so impossible to say, especially now. I mean, I've done so many, and of course it is the question that I get asked the most. I mean, there's places that I love for the look of them, or for the architecture, or for the food, or for the story that I heard. There's some places that I really like because someone told me a story that they had experienced there, and I looked it up in the newspaper archives and found something that matched it exactly. You know, that gave me chills. That was a building in downtown that's actually home to a very large bookstore. It used to be a bank. That was a particular story that I found that I would say, as much as it's possible to say, I'd say that could be a ghost. That could be a ghost in that building. And then there's other buildings that we'll talk about today that are just amazing and that are just worth visiting for any reason. And that I just thought, well, I can't not put them in the book.
You know, we run into the same thing. People will ask us, what's your favorite location that you've done a podcast on? And I'm like, probably the next one I'm working on.
Yeah, because it's always the next thing. I've been doing some research today and I'm thinking about sort of a next book, and I've been looking at the stuff and I'm like, oh, that's quite exciting. I can't wait to get down to the library and get into the, you know, the microfiches again, you know, because it's the undiscovered as opposed to the discovered. You know, I haven't covered a lot of the most famous stories in my two books. You know, I haven't done a lot on the Black Dahlia, and I haven't done anything on the Manson murders, that kind of thing, because there's nothing new I can possibly bring to that. Sure. You know, there's enough crime and enough strange stories without them needing to be famous. So they're really much more interesting to uncover than a path that's been well trodden.
Oh, I agree with you. And you had mentioned earlier a little bit about sometimes the psychic connection. And I was thinking to myself, wow, he is almost psychic, because I was going to ask you, what were the parameters that you looked at when you would include something in the book? Did you look to see if there was some real history to go behind it? Or did you just go with people's stories? And it sounds like you really looked for something that had legitimacy to back up the stories that you were hearing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I really, obviously, if it's something that's, because it's not fiction, so it's a non-fiction book. And if it was in the newspaper, no one could ever say to me that I've just made it up. Mm-hmm. You know, I did read books, and I'm sure you've read them yourself, that are completely, you know, composed of someone going to locations and talking about the feelings and the spiritual connections that they felt they had. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously relevant to them. But it didn't necessarily connect with me because I wasn't them. If I put something in the book that was like, I went there and I spoke to the security guard and he told me that he'd seen this. And then I looked in the newspaper archives and it turns out, much like that story of Whispers, where a story that's usually apocryphal, 9 times out of 10, I found out something really had happened, either in that building or very nearby, that had gone into the consciousness and people had talked about that story. And whether they believe them or not, I rarely, you know, it was partly because I work as a journalist, but I didn't really think I spoke to many people who were leading me on or making it up, because you could always tell from the little details. I didn't ask them, you know, tell me your ghost story, because that gives it away. Mm-hmm. I would always ask about the building and the architecture and you know, be more generally interested. And then usually I also found 9 times out of 10, if there was an unusual story, people always brought it up.
Sure. They love to talk about that stuff.
Yeah, very much so. And the places that didn't like to talk about it, of which there were a few as well. Mm-hmm. And understandably, you know, some hotels don't necessarily want to be related to something that's, even if it is the idea of a ghost, let alone any crime. Sometimes they don't like to talk about it. But if you're just friendly and you have a conversation, and I sort of was making it clear, I'm not pretending to be a psychic or a ghostbuster. You know, I'm not going to sneak in at night with a radio control and cameras to try and film something.
But
then people are more likely to give you a little information, or they will just actually say, no, there's nothing like that. Never has been, you know, forget what it says on the website, forget what you've read online in other books. There's nothing like that at all. And I would take that under advisement, and I might put it in the book and say, you know, the venue themselves had no stories, but this is what I read and found out elsewhere. But usually there was a good correlation between the two.
I was just going to say, it was good that he didn't go in with all the ghost busting equipment and stuff, because you never ever want to tempt those spirits, do you?
Exactly. It is a bit tempting. And of course, you know, the onus is on you to find something then, you know, to come across something that is unexplained or unusual or spooky. And then it seems to be always a little bit unfair. You know, I've met some of these people and they do the events. And of course, the pressure's on them to come across something. And how can you possibly legislate for that? You know, it's the same as someone saying to me, well, how can you prove that there's a ghost there? How could you possibly put that in the book? And I said, well, I can never prove that there's a ghost there. You know, that's impossible. It's like proving that there are UFOs. I can't ever possibly prove that, but I can tell you what I found and what I was told and what's happened at the building, as opposed to going in there in the middle of the night when it's bound to be frightening, when the building is settling and there's 5 people with you who are all expecting something frightening to happen.
Well, we thought, since there's so many locations between both of these books, that it might be fun to do something like, this isn't necessarily the top 10, these are for sure the way that you would rank them, but just 10 places that you think would be wonderful places for people to check out.
Yes, yeah, I did have I put together a top 10 here, and I wouldn't say they were in order. I was sort of I was going to bunch them by place and location, and I thought, but you have readers all over the country, so it's not necessarily, or listeners, I should say, it's not necessarily going to be, if I speak about downtown, they're not going to know it intimately. But I did put a top 10 together of some places, and some you've heard of and some you won't have heard of, yes.
All right. So what do you have down as that first one there?
Well, the first one that I wanted to put down was I tried to be as diverse as possible. But there's a restaurant in downtown LA called La Golondrina, which is a Mexican restaurant, and it's on Olvera Street, which is pretty much the sort of the Mexican touristy version of old L.A. Obviously, L.A. did start in downtown, and the Pueblo de Los Angeles, where it was originally settled, that was an early settlement, and the early Mexican society and community was there. Olvera Street itself is a bit of a construct, but well-meaning. And La Golondrina is one of the eldest restaurants there, possibly the oldest Mexican restaurant in L.A. And I've been in there a couple of times. And, you know, it's a bit of a tourist favorite. It's great. Olvera Street certainly worth a visit if you're coming to LA. And I did speak to some of the people there, and the very charismatic lady who owns the restaurant, Vivian De Bonzo, her name was. And she told me several stories about how her father, who had owned it before her, said that he had seen something and had been scared out of the building. And she said he was a big, big macho man and he was scared. She said that when they've had workmen there, they've seen something, a woman, and this was the thing. It was a woman, a La Consuela, or the mistress is what they called them. And they reckon she was the matriarch of the building going back right to the beginning. And you can still go in to the restaurant now. And there's a picture of it in the book. There's a balcony, which is now in the restaurant, but used to look out onto the street, way back. And she's been seen at that balcony, still looking out over her domain. And she's been seen up in stairs in the staff offices and stuff. And that was a good story, I thought. That was something that had, that definitely had the element of truth to it when I was speaking to her.
Oh, and that's great because they have so many wonderful legends when it comes to Mexican history and such. So that goes hand in hand.
Exactly. Yes, that was what she was saying. I mean, we talked a lot about that. You know, she said, I'm very much a believer in spirits. You know, she had had the building cleared and she had, the building engaged with spiritually. And, you know, she had said, she was talking about, you know, the time that when there were earthquakes proofing the building and that there were strange things were happening there. And I'm just saying, well, you know, strange things like that. Was it an earthquake? You know, this is California, things like that. And she was, no, it was definitely not an earthquake. And I rarely found in either of the books that any people had any frightening experiences. They were often something that was very everyday or not particularly upsetting. Often the people knew who it might be or suspected.
That's nice to hear. And I think for a lot of us, when we do have something that's unexplained, it is one of those, what was that? It wasn't like, you know, you jump and scream and run. It's more like, well, that was weird.
Yes, usually people are frightened and run because they're so surprised. Mm-hmm. Or they see something. And some of the places that I'm going to talk about today, the ghosts and the things that people see there are very common. You know, the staff know about them and talk amongst themselves frequently about it, and it doesn't really particularly frighten them.
Oh, that sounds like a great place, and I bet they have good food there too.
Very good food, yes. I was going to say, for particular, I've got some specific recommendations for these places, but yes, I had some very good shrimp tacos there. Mm. I mean, it's a bit touristy, like I say, but it's a great place.
Wonderful. So what is our next one?
Well, the second one is actually another Mexican place, but it's different this time. This is a tequila bar, which is called El Carmen, and that's on 3rd Street here, which is sort of towards the center of town, towards Beverly Hills. And that's been there for a very long time, from the late 1920s. It was opened by a widow called Encarnacion Gomez, which was quite the scandal at the time. Widowed women didn't tend to open businesses on their own, but she opened it right at the end of the red trolley line, as it was back in the day, and it moved further along to its current location in the 50s. And I know the people in there very well, and I've been there a lot of time. It's now a proper tequila bar. It has, you know, the 400 tequilas that you can choose from. It's very small. It's a very small place. It has a Mexican wrestling theme. It's very popular, quite authentic. And some of the staff had told me there that they've felt cold spots. They've felt sudden drafts. Things have fallen from shelves. And that kind of thing, you know, it isn't especially convincing. But then someone told me that when they first started working there, they finished their shift and found a handful of candy in their coat, actually in the hood of their coat. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's not surprising. You know, maybe someone just, you know, put some candy in there, you know, to be nice. Mm-hmm. But then as I did some further investigation, I found out later that the sister of Encarnacion, and who was called Hortensia, and also her stepdaughter, who was Martha, it was a family business. They all worked over there over the 40 years or so until they sold the business in the late 90s. And I was told, just completely in passing, that Martha and Hortensia used to give out handfuls of candy to people in El Carmen. They used to give them to them unexpectedly, or they used to give them to them when they left. And oh, wow. That, to me, was a bit of a connection. I was like, that is a strange coincidence of the two things. And it's a sweet connection, I thought, you know, and it's a place about restaurants, and this was to do with candy. And I thought, that's a good one for the book. And they also have a couple of, you know, they have cocktails, you know, a Bloody Maria and a True Blood. So I thought, that's a good way to go in. That's a good connection. And it's a very old building. It's one of the oldest in Los Angeles as well. And it's largely unchanged, although a lot smaller.
I love those endearing stories where it's, you know, leaving you candy and that kind of thing.
Very yeah, it was much sweet. More charming. I got a lot of I spoke to a lot of the family members, funnily enough, and they all used to say how much of a pleasant place it used to be to just to hang out, and how the ladies, the sisters, because it was all women, were all so nice and so kind. I mean, I actually found out that Jimi Hendrix was a fan and Mick Jagger was a fan. They were all there in the 60s, and that Fleetwood Mac, the sort of the classic lineup of Fleetwood Mac, actually formed in El Carmen in the late 70s. They all met there for margaritas, and wow. That was where they formed up into the lineup that we know today. So it was a rock hangout, but it was also a place that people really liked.
Oh, very cool. Sounds like a neat location.
Yeah, it's great. It's great fun in there.
Okay, so those are our two Mexican restaurants. Is the next one Mexican as well?
No, I've gone for an Irish one this time. I'm trying to keep the wide selection.
Oh,
this is a place called Tom Bergen's, which is a very old Irish bar, as you might imagine. This is like 1936 in its original location and moved to its original location in the late 40s. It was the bar that was supposed to have inspired Cheers. You remember the TV show?
Yes.
Where everyone knows you. Yes, of course we do. That was supposed to be the inspiration for it. And the head barman, whose name was Chris Doyle, he was supposed to be the inspiration for Coach, who was the character in the early few seasons. But it's pretty much a typical Irish bar. It says Irish coffee outside. It's got a big shamrock sign outside. It has a lot of shamrock, paper shamrocks attached to the ceiling. That's kind of supposed to be a big honor in this town, is if you get your name on a shamrock in Tom Bergen's.
Oh, interesting.
But the main ghost story about that, and this was, again, one that several staff people told me, and it was completely normal, was that Tom Bergen, who, of course, was the owner, who's the late Tom Bergen, is very much often seen regularly still at the bar. He's seen at the bar. He's seen in his favorite booth. He's seen at the dining room in the back. He's near the fireplace. They recognize his suit. This apparition is wearing a suit. And also his smell. He was a cigarette smoker back when you could smoke in the bars. And they said they can smell the cigarette smoke, and he's there. It means that a lot of nighttime cleaning crews quit pretty regularly, I was told. But as for everyone else during the day, they're quite used to him being there. And also in terms of something that happened there, there was a lady who was a long-term regular, and she died in her chair in the 1980s at the end of the bar. They used to let her kind of nod off at the end of the bar anyway, but one night she actually died, and there's a plaque on her seat there. So something did actually happen there, and she's supposed to appear there as well.
So do they know how long she was dead before they realized she wasn't just like nodded off down there?
Well, apparently she used to kind of regularly nod off. So they thought she'd just nodded off, and they did the usual thing of, you know, come on, it's time to go home. And they realized that, you know, she wasn't waking up this particular time.
Oh, wow.
Well, yeah, so she died doing something she loved, I guess.
She did. There was another place I found that's not on the list. It's a tiki bar. You see, I do try and cover all the bases here. There's a tiki bar in North Hollywood here called the Tonga Hut. They had a regular. It was a lady who came in for decades with her husband. And ironically, she never actually drank any of the rum or tiki drink. She was a gin and tonic person. But she and her husband came in for years and years. She carried on after her husband died. And then she too died, and they put a plaque on her chair, and she's been seen apparently still in her seat, still coming in for her regular drink at happy hour.
Oh, and that's at the tiki bar where they do the plaques on the chairs, not at the Irish pub, right?
No, there's one at both. That was the connection. There's a plaque at the in the Irish bar, Tom Bergen's, and they also put a plaque at the regular spot in the tiki bar as well. That's what tends to happen, is that if you're a regular, and I suppose especially if you die at your post, you get a plaque.
You get that honor.
Yes, you do get that honor, yes. And as far as food and drink goes, obviously it's an Irish place. So all I've ever had in there is Guinness, which is very good.
He must have really loved the place since he's sticking around to make sure they're running it right.
That's what they say. They say there's several places in the books, actually, where people have said the former owner's still here and they think it's because they're keeping an eye on the place. Sometimes they're proactive, you know, poking people and prodding the staff, telling them to get moving. And sometimes they're just there. I mean, in fact, at Tom Bergen's, the Irish bar, they have a very big neon sign outside. And the story goes that when it's quiet in the bar, the sign flickers. And they don't know how it's done because it's all on one electric circuit. But when it's quiet, it flickers. And they reckon that's him trying to get a little bit more attention from people driving by to come in for a drink.
That's great. What's our next location?
The next one is called the Tam O'Shanter, which is in Glendale. And as you might guess from the name, it has a very Scottish theme, very much in and out. It looks a bit like a castle sort of mixed with a witch's den on the outside. There's also an English phone box outside as well. And that's, again, this is a very old place. As you can imagine, a lot of the entries in the book tend to be the older places rather than newer places. This is back from the 1920s, 1930s, and pretty much been Scottish-themed throughout. It's gone through a lot of changes, but every time they've tried to change it to something different, it's never worked out, and they went back to the Scottish theme. So there's the staff wear plaid and the kilts, and there are kilts and bagpipes and lots of pictures on the walls and army stuff, that kind of thing. Very, very Scottish. But the big thing about the Tam O'Shanter, or the Tam as they call it, was that Walt Disney and a lot of his Imagineers used to come there. It was near towards where the original studios were. They sort of used it as a studio commissary. and he had his own table, which was number 31. And there are a lot of pictures and things on the walls from these guys over the years who've done doodles and things, often to pay for their lunch, that are on the wall of the Tam O'Shanter. If, to give you an idea, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, or Toad of Toad Hall, if you've ever been to that at the yeah. one here in LA, it's kind of like the Tam O'Shanter is. And Disney are quite open about the fact that he was always there and was always working there. So his ghost is supposed to be there, still haunting his table, which you need a reservation for, of course. There's another room, the Bonnie Prince Charlie room, which was a later addition to the building. There's a ghost of a small child has been seen in there. And of course, they called him Charlie. That's because he's supposed to be the ghost of Bonnie Prince Charlie, who was a Scottish pretender to the English throne. He's been seen. There's supposed to be a group of phantom diners who sit together around a table and a man who just wanders around, although he could be trying to find his way to the bar.
Well, I definitely would like to visit that one. That would be pretty incredible just to see the pictures that were drawn by Walt Disney and his people. That would be really, really cool.
Yeah, it's a really fun place, and it's really great. And it's not quite cheesy. I mean, they actually have some very good ales, and they have some very nice food, and it's part of a prime rib chain, but it's not as awful as that might sound. So they do a very good roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. But the place itself is very well known. It's a super sort of Disney place. There's actually another bar on Hollywood Boulevard called the Snow White Bar, which is very touristy, nothing special at all, but has pictures of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs on the walls, like murals. And you always wonder how they managed to get away with that, because Disney's very protective of its assets. But it turns out at the time, Walt Disney or Walt Disney's employees did actually go to that bar very regularly and drew all that stuff on the walls themselves. So it's actually officially allowed to continue to be the Snow White Cafe, it's called. And it's nothing special. It's very small, very touristy, big pints of, beer for $6, that kind of thing. But inside, if you actually go in, beautiful, the murals.
Now, is that anywhere near the one that has where Disney and his friends went?
No. Nothing's far from each other in Los Angeles. But if you're talking with driving, yes, then it could be 40 minutes. But no, it's not exceptionally far, but it's not the same part of town. No, but it's in the same direction, because all the studios were a little bit out of town. It's a bit of a misnomer that all the studios were in Hollywood per se. They were all a little bit further towards what we call the Valley, which was sort of over the hill of Hollywood. And so that's where all the original studios were, and that's where they all worked. So they would all come and try and eat and drink locally.
Well, I have to ask about the Scottish place. Do they serve haggis there?
They do serve haggis there.
Okay.
Which I don't know how many people actually have it. I mean, I've had haggis before, and I quite like, blood pudding and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But that is quite a sort of an English-Scottish thing. And most people here, especially, when you mention anything like that, they're sort of choke gagging for anything like that, because it hasn't got kale in it. So...
Yeah. Well, what about vegetarian haggis?
We have.
What's the point of that? Vegetarian haggis. That's like a misnomer.
What's funny is I have a friend who's from Scotland, and she kept telling me that I would have to try haggis, and they have the Epcot Food and Wine Festival here, and they have little booths for each country. And
yes.
At Scotland, they were serving vegetarian haggis. So I told her, hey, we finally tried haggis. It was vegetarian. And she goes, what?
Yeah. Yes, it makes sense. And it's probably, it's a very acquired taste. It's a bit like, liver and blood pudding and that kind of thing. It, you either like it or you don't. And haggis, initially, even as a concept, is enough to put people off.
Gotcha. Well, what's our next location?
Okay, there's another place towards where the Tam O'Shanter is. It's called El Cid, which is actually, it's not another Mexican place, it's a Spanish place. And this goes back a very, very long way. I found out about it a couple of years ago. It's very well known for its paella is obviously the main attraction there, the sangria and flamenco. They have a stage there, and they do a lot of flamenco events, flamenco dancing. It was basically set up as a flamenco bar way back in 1915. They can trace the address itself back to D.W. Griffith, who was filming Birth of a Nation very nearby, may have even built part of the building to do with that. In the early 20s, it was called the Jail Cafe, which I don't know if you've ever seen any of them. We're very used today to themed cafes, that might have like a dinosaur theme or, like the Heart Attack Grill in Vegas. They have a big theme.
Mm-hmm.
This was a theme cafe, and it was laid out like a jail. So you went in and it looked like a jail. So you would sit in a cell with like a simple table, and the waiters would be dressed as convicts, and there were essentially three meals you could have because it was a jail. And there, on the outside, it looked like a jail, and there would be people standing. Well, they weren't real people, but it looked like there were guards in the towers. And that was the jail cafe. That was what it was first. And then in the 60s, it became El Cid, and it was very much specifically conceived as a place for flamenco, for the Spanish lifestyle. Now, as far as ghosts go, that was another place where I did a talk there, and everyone on the staff was very, very clear that there was a ghost here, more than one. They were saying there's a mischievous ghost who smashes glasses, turns the lights on and off, locks himself in the bathroom. That was one that came up a lot, the bathroom locks. And I said, well, but surely someone's just in the bathroom and can't undo the lock, you know, because the lock's on the inside. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, it's just locked all the time. You can never get in there, and there's never anyone in there. Someone say they saw that they've seen bottles float across the bar. There was a guy when I was there said he'd seen someone the night before with a ponytail walking through the bar at about 3 a.m. And there are two suspects as to who the ghost might be. And they both died within a year of each other, funnily enough. There's a guy called Gino Dori. He was the resident guitarist. He was the resident guitarist for like 35 years. His dressing room, they still call the dressing room Gino's dressing room. And there's a picture of him in there above the ATM. They reckon he could be the ghost. And also Clark Allen, who's the actual owner of the El Cid, he and his wife and El Cid. He was a folk singer as well and an occasional actor. And they reckon he could possibly be the ghost as well, because very often there's guitar playing heard coming from the stage when everything's closed and switched off. And they were both musicians. Gino, especially, of course, was the flamenco guitarist, or the resident flamenco guitarist. So that was a place, El Cid. It's a beautiful place. You go down off the street level and down onto a big patio, and then inside is the huge stage with the velvet curtains and the lovely paella on the weekends. And the staff, absolutely, it's Gino or it's Clark or it's someone else, but they all had stories of ghosts.
Wow. You know, I love that you've been to all these places and tried the food. That's just great.
Well, that's the thing. And like I say, sometimes I've only gone there for, you know, like a happy hour or had a drink. I mean, I did find that for the second book. I concentrated less on the food for the second book because I realized a lot of restaurants change their menus quite frequently.
Sure.
And a lot of restaurants are also seasonal. So I was realizing that people would open the book and go, well, this isn't it. They haven't got this on the menu, you know, because it's summer instead of winter. But what I also found out was that in this particular area, as you can probably imagine, it wasn't the food and drink that people were the most interested in. You know, it's not real. I'm not a food critic.
Sure.
You know, it was just that, you know, I had to mention something that was in the restaurants and the bars, because otherwise it looks like I could have just stuck a pin in the map.
Well, yeah, and if you're using the title Gourmet Ghost, they might think, well, are you talking about the ghosts are cooking something?
Yes, that's right. I mean, a lot of people initially thought it was, you know, famous lunches that, you know, people had with famous people, you know, famous lunches, you know, like,
sure.
And I was thinking, well, I haven't had any lunches with anyone famous, so it's obviously not me. But I just thought that because of the G and the G, and gourmet was just for the food, and then ghost was for the ghost. I was desperate to come up with something memorable, I thought, because I didn't think a single person would buy a copy. And I thought, well, I have to have a good name. If I have a good name, people can remember it.
It's a good name. All right. So what is our next place?
Okay. The next one is, this is moving into Hollywood proper, into the Hollywood Hills, which is several hundred meters above Hollywood Boulevard and the Chinese Theater and the Walk of Fame. There's a place called Yamashiro, which, again, I've never really realized how diverse all these restaurants are, but I'm quite impressed. This was inspired by the Japanese mountain palace, Yamashiro. It was actually built by two brothers from Germany about 1913. And they were very rich, and they had been traveling around Asia, as was the way in those days. And they wanted a mansion to show all their many treasures, which they had imported and bought while they were away. And it's when you look at it, and I won't go into it now, but the money they spent on this place, it was millions of dollars. And this is 100 years ago. They bought craftsmen from Japan, from China. And there's an enormous bodega. Excuse me. There's a bodega there. The mansion is made of teak and cedar. The rafters were lacquered in gold. There are bronze dragons in there. There's an inner court garden. I mean, it really is amazing. It's not only is it one of the best views in LA, but the building itself is amazing. And then there's the outside. There's huge landscaping. There's trees and shrubs, waterfalls. They used to have lots of goldfish in there. There used to be a private zoo in there. little houseboats. There's a Japanese village. It just goes on and on. They have black swans in there that were imported.
Wow.
It's an amazing place. It's beautiful. And it still very much looks as it did from when it was originally built. It's had a very interesting history, which I won't go into. But the current owners, or at least until actually the end of last year, restored it. They took me down into the basement because there was talk that there were secret tunnels that led down from this Yamashiro down onto the street. And there were old Chinese artifacts in their bells and pictures. And it was beautiful. It was amazing. As for the ghost stories, again, that was very clear. The staff were all very much, they just accepted it as part of regular life at the Yamashiro. So several security guards had seen and heard people in rooms. They'd heard children crying, gone up to it to look, didn't find anybody there, came down. The big story that I heard was that there was talk quite a few years ago, of the family called the Glover family, who owned Yamashiro and another building that I'm just going to talk about, were looking to sell it. And they had arranged together, they have a big meeting in one of the rooms. It's got lots and lots of rooms and lots of rings. It's sprawled out. And there was an enormous sudden cacophony of noise. And it seemed like all the glasses and all the plates were being thrown off all the shelves. There was an enormous row. And all the family took that as some sort of message from beyond that they should not sell. And they didn't. And the irony being, of course, at the end of last year, they did sell to another company. But they did sell it at the end of last year. But Thomas Glover, who's the original patriarch of the family, his ashes are in the central inner court garden. So he will always be there forever. And of course, the staff think he's still there. People have heard women walking around on the outside in the gardens when there's been no one there. There were many, many stories for Yamashiro. I mean, about the best one was the sunset room, which is sort of one of these enormous wings of the building. There's a table number 9, which is right at the end, right at the side. It's got the best view, so you can never get it. You have to get a reservation. That's supposed to have a woman ghost who's seen sitting there all the time. And a psychic came in, one of my few psychic stories, and I was told that she had come in and felt that there was a woman who was waiting there and had been waiting eternally for her husband to arrive. And that was a good story. And I thought that goes in there. And that's Yamashiro. It's an amazing place. It's as you might imagine, it's sort of sushi and soju and that kind of food. And it's overpriced for what it is. But the view is absolutely amazing. And the building is amazing. And so that definitely goes in there. And that was, again, another place where the staff were very much, I mean, as soon as I hit my mouth, and I was having the conversation, people were butting in and going, oh, yes, and then I saw this, and this happened here, and there's supposed to be one of the people who worked at the bar, still there, walks through the bar. So that was a really interesting one.
It sounds like a beautiful place, and I'm just amazed when you said it was two German guys that built it to begin with.
Yeah, it was two German guys, and they were a real interesting pair. One of them was very handsome, one of them was not. And he was even supposed to have had a hunchback, the less handsome one. And yet they were both very successful with the ladies, although, of course, they're both very rich. But, of course, they both suffered a fair bit in the two wars.
Mm-hmm.
They actually had to close down. And they were even during the Second World War, they thought that it was being used as a lighthouse, you know, to signal the Germans and signal the Japanese, you know, because it's right at the top of the hills.
Mm-hmm.
And they closed it. And that was kind of the end for them after the war, because the people were suspicious and they kind of realized that they had to go. So it's an enormously interesting story, and it's an extremely popular place to go and visit. And it's still there, and you know, it's 100 years old. It's over 100 years old.
Neat. All right, what's our next place?
Okay, well, then the next one is actually right under Yamashiro on the same hill. It's right underneath it. It's called the Magic Castle, which you may have heard of. Really look like a magic castle you'd expect to look like a Disney castle. And it was built by a guy called Milt Larson and his brother and his wife, and literally kind of built out of old movie sets and old TV sets and stuff he used to go down and get out of skips and get out of when they were redoing downtown. He used to go and, you know, take staircases and take pieces from old buildings. And he and his magician friends, it's a magician's club. It really is. It's a serious place in that terms. It's they call it the Mecca for magicians. It's a magician's club. So it has a library, and it has a museum, and it has enormous amount of posters and ephemera on the wall, which are amazing.
Mm.
And it has five theaters in there. They built five theaters, which are for magic performances. So when you go there, you have to book in advance. It's a club, so you kind of have to know someone to get in. You book in, you have dinner. There's five bars, so you can have a drink, you have dinner, and then there's the shows, which are at least two or three of the theaters. And there are also magicians walking around doing close-up magic. Wow. And it's really quite an experience. And so that's the Magic Castle that opened in the early 60s. And as you can imagine, it is quite Disney. It's a little bit Disney in a way. It's very fun. They have their most famous ghost is Invisible Irma, who sits at a piano and plays tunes. If you put a dollar on the little table and shout out a tune, she plays a tune for you. Now, she has been captured on film. There's a very, very surprisingly clear postcard of her, although she is all just a white sheet. And she plays tunes, amazingly up-to-date tunes, on her piano. She has a parrot in a cage, a skeleton parrot. He's alive as well, and he taps along to the music. And there is supposed to be... So that's very fun. But she's supposed to invoke based on a real person. But I think Milt Larson, who's often there, he has a big moustache. He has lots of stories. So I think we can all take it with a bit of a pinch of salt. But it is enormous fun. But he did, as I've spoken to him a number of times, I've interviewed him several times because he's got so many stories. He did tell me there are a couple of genuine ghost stories there. The first one is one of the bars is called the Hat and Hair Bar, which is an old English bar. He got the bar from somewhere else, and he bought these places. I mean, it really is. If you walk around with him, he goes, you know, that's from The Late Show, and that's from this program, and that was from a magic show he did, and that was from I Found That Downtown, and that was... It's really built like that. It was a house originally, obviously, but he really made it into this thing. He said there's a bar there called the Hat and Hair. And he said he gets people coming up to him regularly saying, that barman at the Hat and Hair, he's such a nice man. He's so pleasant. We were talking to him. We had a drink. He's so nice. And of course, Milt always says, yes, he is. He is lovely. And he knows there's no one at the bar. It's not a bar that opens regularly. He doesn't schedule people to work there. He says it's the ghost of the bartender, who was called Lauren Tate. He said that happens all the time. He said, you know, I know exactly who works here, and I schedule all the working. People come up to me and say, we've just been at the Hat and Hair. The bartenders were so friendly, and I know there's no one there. That there's no one working there. It has to be him. He also said that the Palace of Mystery, which is one of the theatres there, they're big. There's a very big theatre, and then they get progressively smaller. There was an elderly magician called Chris Michaels who was waiting, I guess, like at his post, as if it was a bar. He was sitting behind stage waiting to go on in a chair, and he just passed away in his sleep. Hmm. So they called him up to come on stage and that it was his time to perform, and found he had just died in his sleep. And then as far as drinks go, we haven't mentioned drinks for a couple, but they have a couple of good drinks there. There's a Corpse Reviver number 2, which is a good one, very good for Halloween, for zombies. And then there's a Billy's Nutty Irishman, which is coffee with Baileys and Frangelico. And that was developed for Billy McComb, who was a very nice chap I interviewed a few times. He was an Irish magician who'd been over in America for, 1,000 years. And he died a few years ago, but they still say that his ghost haunts the Magic Castle as well. So they concocted that drink in honor of him. Apparently his favorite was Captain Morgan's rum. That was his drink. But they made a Nutty Irishman in honor of him, and his ghost is supposed to be there as well.
You know, these stories like what you told with the bartender are the ones that always amaze me, because it's somebody who is full-bodied enough that they think it's an actual real person. And if they're saying they were friendly, they had to have carried on a conversation, and possibly this ghost mixed a drink for them. It just, how do they do that?
It has to be something. I mean, it could easily have been that, you know, it was a mistake, or that there was someone working the bar temporarily, mm-hmm. or whatever. But he's mentioned this a number of times, and he's always said to me, but like I say, you know, the Magic Castle is sort of full of chandeliers and sliding bookcases and owls and, you know, mystery staircases and things. You know, there's a seance room in there as well that's a Harry Houdini room, and you can book it for a seance, and, you know, the table will go up and down and it'll make lots of noises. So he's an excellent storyteller, and whether that was another one of his stories, who knows? But he said that does happen a lot, that people come to him in relation to that bar and say that the barman was there. And, you know, it could only have been the briefest of conversations, and maybe the barman didn't even speak. Mm-hmm. But he said that that's happened a number of times.
Wow. And he has no reason to lie about it, so that's fascinating.
Well, he kind of does, because people come there and they love all that stuff. But that's part of the fun, though, and he would say that himself. he would say that himself. I mean, it's not, you know, a serious place. You know, it's a magician's club. It's, sure. it's a place of illusion and trickery. It really is. I mean, that's exactly what they're about. And so, of course, they have, you know, the ghost who plays the piano. But he's told me a couple of other things. There's one other thing when he came down. There was a power cut, which we do get occasionally here, or a blackout. And he said he had been staying at the Magic Castle because he has an office there. And he said one evening he was woken up and he looked out the window and saw, you know, when you look down and all the lights are out in the street.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew there'd been a blackout and the Magic Castle was completely dark as well. And so he was fumbling his way down the stairs to try and get to the electricity switches. And he heard the piano playing, which of course is Invisible Irma. And he was like, that was frightening because I knew it was electrically run. And I knew it couldn't work. It wasn't working on its own.
Uh-huh.
You know, it can't work on its own. I mean, because, you know, I mean, I'm not giving away any secrets, but, you know, behind the bar, they do it. You know, they switch on the thing, sure. And that's how they make it, you know, the keys move,
mm-hmm.
You know. And he said that was actually frightening. He said because he knew there was no electricity and he couldn't understand how that was working.
Yeah, that would freak me out just a little bit, especially when all the power is out and the lights are out. So you're already in that frame of mind and then you hear something that shouldn't be going.
Oh,
exactly. Yes.
I think I would wet my pants.
All right. What's our next location?
Okay. I've sort of ended up with two or three famous ones here, which you might have heard of. So apologies if you know the story, but the Roosevelt Hotel, which is in Hollywood. That's a very famous hotel. They did the first Oscar ceremony was at the hotel here. And again, that was opened in 1927. It was the hotel where Marilyn Monroe was supposed to have been discovered on the swimming pool diving board. There was a mirror there that you probably have read about a lot of times called Marilyn's Mirror that was there for a long time in the hotel, though it's not there anymore. They moved it. No one really seems to know where it is, but it's called Marilyn's Mirror. It's a very large mirror and it was in the hotel and it's supposed to have been said that one night one of the cleaning ladies saw Marilyn Monroe's reflection in the mirror very clearly and was completely freaked out. And so they, of course, put the mirror kind of on display. It's got like a sort of a Marilyn, I don't even know, etching next to it. And lots of people have said that they've seen her reflection in the mirror over the years, but they did move it two or three years ago and no one really seems to know where it is. So I think they probably got a little bit tired of people just coming in to look at the mirror. But the main ghost story there is to do with Montgomery Clift, who's the actor who I'm sure you remember. He stayed at the hotel when he was doing From Here to Eternity, and he played a bugler. He was an army bugler in that movie, and he used to play the bugle or try and play the bugle and walk up and down the corridors doing his lines and practicing his instrument. That's supposed to be something that people still hear. They hear the bugle still playing. They hear someone going up and down the corridor at night. They even had a woman who came to stay at the hotel at one time and asked to stay in his room that he'd been in, which is very common in a lot of hotels that have stories like this. People ask for the specific room. And she brought a Ouija board with her and was trying to contact Montgomery Clift and ended up, whatever happened, she ended up checking out very early in the middle of the night, completely frightened, apparently, was what I was told by the staff. And then in the 80s, they reopened after a renovation. People have reported the sounds of children playing. There's been a ghost girl has been seen by the fountain in the lobby. Now, that was something I read a lot about. She's supposed to be called Caroline, this girl, and was supposed to be related to a telephone call that was placed to somebody who had come to the hotel with his children. And he was called up and his daughter was on the end of the line. And, you know, he'd left them alone and she had died. Now, I didn't know whether it was an accident or whether it was in the hotel or in the pool or in the room or something, but she's supposed to still be there. But I couldn't find any actual information for that in the newspaper archives, which chances are that would have been made the papers in some way. I mean, every hotel, as I found out doing my research, every hotel has had suicides happen in it for obvious reasons. So that's happened in every hotel. And so, you know, there have been suicides at the Roosevelt Hotel. I mean, there's one in 1932 here for a start. But the main reason that it's famous is because of Montgomery Clift. And people do go and visit that hotel specifically. There are bus tours here and history tours and ghost tours. And the Roosevelt Hotel is Montgomery Clift is supposed to still be there, still pacing the corridors, still learning his coronet, I think it was, or trumpet.
Well, you know what's interesting is the noise of a bugle is not something that you would typically hear in a room or
on
a street.
Not at all, no. I mean, even with some of the hideous music that they play today, I mean, there's a very good swimming pool, like a David Hockney designed pool that's very hip, and they play music there. But even then, I think there'd be a stretch to hear, you know, the sound of a trumpet.
And Denise, you heard that woman brought a Ouija board into that room, so she was tempting the spirits, and she went running out of there. So that's what you get, you know.
Absolutely. And the one thing that's really struck me is a lot of these have children ghosts, and
yes,
they're like bars, yeah, and stuff like that. So it's kind of weird that there's children spirit there.
Yes, yeah, so that does turn up quite frequently, as I found. The idea of the woman in a white dress or a black dress or a red dress, that turns up fairly commonly, and often a small child, often a small girl. And I guess, you know, they're kind of related, a child and a woman, or a girl and a woman. But I think it also represents in that way, especially as like something tragic, something innocent. You know, there's often probably nothing more upsetting than the death of a child. And so the idea of seeing a small child that has died, or that is, you know, is a spirit or hasn't passed on, is a lot more upsetting than, you know, seeing a man in a suit, where you might assume that something had happened and at least he'd had some sort of life. Whereas a child is always so much more upsetting, and you want to help, and it's emotionally engaging, as opposed to an adult, which, you know, if it happened 100 years ago and they were poisoned, you couldn't have done anything about it. You see a child, your natural instinct, I think, is to be protected.
Sure, I agree. All right, what's our next location?
Okay, the next one is a place called Barney's Boonery, which has a good alliterative name. That's in West Hollywood. They have two or three outlets, but this is the original one. And it was originally on Route 66 when Route 66 came through that part of town, which it doesn't anymore. But it was originally on Route 66, and it does have some quite sort of famous stories associated with it. Quentin Tarantino was supposed to have written a lot of Pulp Fiction sitting at the bar here. Jim Morrison was supposed to have urinated on the bar, so I hope nobody's having their dinner at this time. There's actually a plaque for that, believe it or not. There's actually a plaque at the bar where it shows where Jim Morrison didn't necessarily sit, but he was obviously standing at the time. And it was also the last place that Janis Joplin had. She had her final drink before she went back to her hotel room, which isn't that far away from Barney's Beanery. She had her final drink there, and that's certainly documented. It was her regular hangout when she was there. So that was the last place that served Janis Joplin. But in terms of ghosts, I spoke to several people there, and a number of them had told me about a man in black. That was what they told me about. They were saying that he's been felt in. It's a very large place, very much like a sports bar, very colorful and loud, lots of TVs, lots of beer, ephemera and souvenirs, quite tight aisles, quite thin aisles. So people have felt someone squeezing past them in the aisles, and there's been no one there. He's been seen by the bathrooms, which are at the back, even the walk-in fridge. I'd heard several stories about that, where obviously it's a walk-in fridge, it's very cold, but the kegs will move around on their own. And I said, well, you know, it's cold, they could be icy, you know, the ground could be a little bit wet. But I was being told it's not that at all. You know, they'll move up the slope rather than down the slope. So as far as a man in black goes, you know, I tried to look in the archive to see if something actually relates to a crime that happened there. And many years ago, where all the arcade games are now, there was a pool table and sort of gambling den at the back. And in 1973, one of the bartenders at Barney's Beanery was killed in a shooting after a game of pool. Mm. So that could be the man in black. He would still be there, you know, because he'd been killed in a game of pool, and he'd obviously lost. So he was owed money. Mm-hmm. And then there was a very odd story that I was told. I'll try and keep short, but it was so odd when I found it. Someone who worked there told me she had heard that there had been a murder right outside the bar. A jealous husband had killed another man right outside. And I thought, well, I can look that up. That's something that I can look up. And it turns out in 1963, there was a confrontation between someone who had been at Barney's Beanery and another guy who owned actually another restaurant nearby. And they had been, you know, fighting over the same wife. There was a jealousy thing. There was a fight. And one of the guys shot the other guy. And whether it was right outside Barney's Beanery, but it was in that area, because even the second restaurant was nearby. And so I looked that up, and it was quite a scandal at the time. But the weirdest thing was that the guy who was the murderer, who went to prison for manslaughter for 10 years for killing his love rival, as it were, had actually killed someone before using judo, but that was justifiable homicide. But he later in his life, after being paroled, became Father Yod. Did you ever hear of that cult? Father Yod and the Family, the Source Family?
I have not.
That was a cult in the late 60s and 70s. And he was the leader of it. It was a pretty harmless sort of sex, drugs, rock and roll hippie cult. And they all lived together. He had 13 wives and you know, hundreds of children. And they lived together on the earnings from the restaurant that he still owned. It was a vegetarian restaurant. But they ended up moving to Hawaii because he was worried about the apocalypse. And I think it was in Hawaii where he died in a hang gliding accident. Now, not that this necessarily relates to Barney's Beanery at all. However, what a great story. And there is the man in black.
Well, it is a great story, and you have to think, maybe his whole Armageddon was the fact that did you say he had 13 wives?
13 wives, yeah, yes.
He was definitely going for the tempting the spirits part.
Yes, no wonder he went hang gliding, because that's something you do on your own, isn't it? Yeah. He was definitely on his own there. Get away from all the wives and the children.
All right, and now we have the final one.
Yes, and like I say, it's not necessarily the best one or the worst one or whatever, but I had to mention this because it is something to do with something very famous. It is the Biltmore Hotel, which is in downtown Los Angeles. Again, it's another one of the originals of 1910, 1920 luxury downtown hotels, and it still is. It's one of the few hotels that were built downtown that has stayed a luxury hotel, as it were. So it's completely glitzy and gold, chandeliers, staircases, angels everywhere. There's a tinkling piano. You can have afternoon tea there. Still very, it's beautiful. It's a gorgeous place. They held some of the early Oscar ceremonies there, although the Roosevelt had the first. And it does have an immediate ghost connection, because in Ghostbusters, the 1984 movie, it was in their lobby where they caught the first ghost. In the story, they filmed there. It was called the Sedgwick Hotel in the movie, but it was the Biltmore Hotel was where they filmed it. So there's a bit of a ghost connection. But as far as the hotel goes, I spoke to a couple of security guards, and there were a lot of stories there. There's been a man in a stovepipe hat has been seen in a corner of one of the function rooms. Children running across a balcony in another one of the function rooms, which is a locked balcony. You can't get to it. But the most famous thing to do with the Biltmore Hotel is that it was the last place where the Black Dahlia was seen alive. And of course, you know all about that story.
Oh, yes, definitely. And it's interesting that this was the last place that she was seen alive. It makes you wonder if she met the person who ended up leaving her dead in a very grotesque way, if that's where she met this person.
Well, that's right. And of course, in researching my second book, I did do, I went into a dive bar in Hollywood called the Frolic Room, and I was talking to the bartender there. She'd worked there for a very long time, and she was telling me about when she'd talked to the bartender who worked there in the late 40s, which was when Elizabeth Short was murdered. He said that she had come in there because the Biltmore Hotel was the last place she was officially seen alive. But there's many accounts I've read where she was seen in other places, because she wasn't found dead until a few days later. Mm-hmm. So, and she reckoned at the Frolic Room that she had met a guy there, and that's the guy who had killed her. But the thing is, and sort of going back to the theme of the book with food and drink, is that at the Biltmore Hotel, they created a cocktail for the Black Dahlia. So it's called the Black Dahlia Cocktail. And I mean, if you can picture it, it's got vodka. It has black raspberry liqueur and Kahlua. So it's a completely black drink. Comes to you in like a martini glass with a little wisp of orange or lemon, and it tastes horrible. But, you know, that's not the point. The point is that it was, you know, created for her. Uh-huh. And there was, when I talked to the security guard, he told me that he had been there one night when two cleaners who were working there had been frightened by something in a restaurant called Bernard's, which is in the Rendezvous Court area where they have the afternoon teas. It's off this Rendezvous Court area. It used to be a French restaurant, but now it just does functions. He said they've been cleaning in there, and they'd come running out, and they'd seen something that they call a black ghost or a black spirit. And I thought, okay, black spirit, Black Dahlia, that's a pretty decent connection.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And so, and again, the Biltmore is absolutely beautiful. There's a lovely bar in there called the Gallery Bar, which is gorgeous and is worth going in. I mean, every time I go downtown, I take a shortcut through the hotel just to walk through it because it's so gorgeous.
And her ghost has been seen there, is that correct?
Her ghost has been seen there, but like a lot of but some other ones, her ghost has been seen at a lot of places.
Sure.
You know, often her ghost is seen, you know, and she's wearing all black and she's wearing sort of a tight black dress, and she wasn't last seen wearing a black dress. She wasn't, you know, that kind of thing. I wouldn't have mentioned it so much if the security guard there hadn't told me how these women had said that they'd seen a black ghost. And I thought, okay, well, that's a black presence. If she's the Black Dahlia, people love the idea of the Black Dahlia, and it was the last place she was seen alive, at least officially. That's good enough of a connection for me. I mean, there are other stories at the Biltmore Hotel, of course, but that's always pretty much going to be the most famous one.
Well, this was like, I felt like we just went on an international tour of LA.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm glad it's meant to be fun. I was going to say, I sound very serious when I'm doing all this, but it is a fun book. It's a fun book. It's like a fun read. They're all sort of bite-sizey chunks of information. And there's some funny stuff in there as well, especially in the second book. I put a few more sort of weird and odd things in, so that because there's nothing weirder than real life was what I found. You know, you can't make a lot of these stories up because real life is weirder.
That is very true. Absolutely. You know, you gave everybody a little bit of a taste of all of the places that you have in your book. So I encourage everybody to check them out. I'm looking forward to reading both of them. Where can people get a hold of them?
They're on Amazon, of course. And if you live in Los Angeles, they're available in quite a few stores here across the city, which is lucky. But on the whole, everyone can get them on Amazon, like everything these days.
Well, very cool. Well, James, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate you contacting us and letting us know that your book was out there. And I think you're going to do really well with both of them. They just look like fascinating. And like you said, fun. And you went, well, I sound pretty serious. Actually, you have an upbeat sound to your voice. So you sounded like you were having fun telling the stories. I enjoyed it.
Yes, it's all very much fun. And there's more stuff on the website, which is gourmetghosts.com, and of course Facebook, Twitter, and all of those. And so I put more stuff up on there, and other stories that make it into the book and so forth, and new things I find. So I'm always putting stuff up because it's just interesting and people like it, and I'm interested.
Thank you again, James, for joining us, and you have a great night.
Thank you very much.